Welcome, guys, to episode 23 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, your host, and my next guest is Paul Roberts. Now, Paul is a Utah firefighter, but is and was, prior to becoming a firefighter, a strength and conditioning coach. He worked with the gym Jim Jones, who was the gym behind the 300 movie, getting the actors prepared for that. More importantly, he has been adapting his coaching philosophy to fit the firefighter and first responder community. One area that I've always kind of struggled with is programming for firefighters. If you guys are kind of aware, I haven't put anything out there as far as workouts or programming myself, because I look at myself as a conduit for all these great coaches. So always looking for places where you can find good workouts for your crews. There are some phenomenal ones out there. I will definitely give a shout out to 555 Fitness. They post workouts every day. A lot of them are in memory of fallen firefighters. And Paul was another one. He teamed up with John Spira from Fit to Fight Fire, and they've put out a program again for training firefighters. So that was part of the focus of this podcast, along with Paul's very interesting history with Jim Jones and his profession prior to becoming a firefighter that we delve into. And just kind of reeling in and bringing a regular ground level firefighter back to the podcast. I like to revisit our profession every few episodes before we branch off to Navy SEALs and doctors and authors and all these other amazing men and women that we have on the show. So, without further ado, I bring to you Utah firefighter, now engineer, recently promoted, Paul Roberts. Enjoy. Welcome, Paul, to the show. Thank you so much for coming on. Where are you calling us from today?
I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. Thanks so much for having me. I'm honored to be on this podcast with you, James.
Well, likewise, mate. I mean, I'm honored to have every single person that I've had so far. So my Skype list is getting cooler and cooler every week. So, all right. So were you originally from Utah? Is that where you were raised?
Yeah, I was born and raised here in Salt Lake City. Honestly, I haven't traveled out too much, other than I grew up playing hockey and got to see a lot of the western states and up into Canada through that. But other than that, all the traveling I've done has really been only because of hockey. So yeah, born and raised in Salt Lake, and really enjoy it here. It's an amazing location. We've got a wide variety of things to do and outdoor activities, and it's an amazing place to live.
Brilliant. And how was your family unit? Was it a traditional, normal upbringing, or anything unusual?
No, pretty standard. You know, we're you know, middle class. I mean, Salt Lake City, you know, there's no like the rough streets of Salt Lake City by any means. where I was raised was kind of lower middle class. My parents were amazing individuals. They're probably two of the nicest people I've ever met. They're willing to do anything. And, you know, I pride myself on the man that I've become, and I attribute a lot of that to my parents. You know, I was adopted, so my parents were, you know, they're not my biological parents. But with that said, you know, even if I, you know, I wouldn't have been able to pick better people to adopt me. So I'm forever grateful for them and how they raised me.
Very cool. Yeah, I was told I was adopted many times, but it's usually through anger. So
yeah, it's one of my my defaults. You know, whenever I mess up in life, I've got two little excuses that I use. Is, you know, one's I'm adopted and the other is I'm left-handed. So you go figure, fighting, yeah, an uphill battle.
All right. So in your childhood, you mentioned hockey. So tell me about the sports that you did growing up and your athletic side.
Cool. Yeah, I got into martial arts as a, you know, really young. I was probably around six. Got into a traditional Japanese martial art called Wataru. I did that for, it was a number of years. I think it was about seven or so. Ultimately, until I got my black belt, I think I was around 13. There was a few failed tests in there. I mean, I don't know how much you know. I think we talked a little while ago, and you do know of Wataru, is that correct?
Yeah, I did Shotokan, so it was. I know they're kind of sister arts.
Yeah, for sure. It was, you know, I mean, it was. I choose not to pay attention to how old I am, but I think I'm around 34. In the early 90s, you know, it wasn't that long ago by any means, but things were, you know, a little different, you know. That particular art wasn't easy. There was definitely no participation trophies. And I remember going to class and, you know, when I got big enough to be in the adults' classes, I remember getting beat up pretty good. And even in tournaments, you know, the protection we would wear were just those little, I don't know if you remember them, those little cotton gloves and the little cotton foot pads. And it was pretty much full contact except for the head, which, you know, you're supposed to pull your punches. But I remember growing up getting bloody noses all the time. It wasn't easy. I mean, to a certain extent, coming up and going through the ranks and earning those belts, they kind of came, but once you got to that brown level, it wasn't easy. I remember taking my third degree brown belt test a couple times, and then same with my black belt test. It took me a couple times to get it.
Right.
And while I was going through, actually, you know, this kind of goes back to my father and the type of man he was and what he distilled in me is there was a point where I was a third degree brown belt, and I had tested once for my black, and I was burnt out on martial arts, and I honestly wanted to quit. I was getting involved in hockey, and that's kind of where my passion was in hockey. And my dad sat me down, and he literally put everything on paper and put it out in front of me, and, you know, showed me how much time I had invested in this. And, you know, the ultimate goal was that black belt and how close I was. And if I could put it out, you know, muster up the gumption to stick it out for another few months and try to test again, I could attain that goal. And he also, you know, I'll never forget that conversation. It was a very pivotal conversation in my life. You know, as a like I said, like about 13, it was a pivotal moment, and you know, I stuck it out and got the black belt. It was pretty rewarding. I like I said, my passions at that point were definitely in hockey, though. So I got the black belt. I stayed going for a few months, but then hockey ended up taking over.
Right. Yeah. Just to touch on the cotton mitts, I remember those so clearly. So you had that white kind of elastic thing that you put over your hand, and then the pad, but when you made a fist, the pad stayed on the back of your hand and your knuckles were completely exposed to punch each other in the face.
Yep.
So yeah, real top engineering there.
Yeah, there wasn't as much R&D back then with gloves, and especially in martial arts. You know, I mean, boxing, you know, that's been around for centuries and centuries, but and so is martial arts, but it just, yeah, the R&D or something wasn't there, or maybe it wasn't as big a deal, but I remember it being, you know, it was definitely hard.
Yeah. Or maybe all the test dummies, the participants died, so they never had any feedback of whether it was a good product or not.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
But, all right. So speaking of MMA, so you then, at what point did you transition into MMA and back into martial arts?
After I played a couple years in it was called the Western States Hockey League, that junior B league. Again, I was, like I said, that's all I did was play hockey growing up. So I was burnt out. And I was ready to do something else. And that was probably, 2002-ish. I had that kind of martial arts background growing up, and I had always been interested in it, and specifically more, you know, what I would say more practical martial arts that are more useful in, you know, combat. And so I started, one of my buddies was, he does his research. He's so good at looking and doing research and finding out, you know, who the best in the area is. And he did some research and he wanted to start up as well. And we found this guy named Will Bernalis, who is a local to Salt Lake. He came up in Virginia, but he came out here. I don't know if you know Pedro Sauer.
That name doesn't ring a bell, but I probably recognize the face, I'm sure.
Yeah, he was one of the first Gracie black belts that wasn't a Gracie.
Okay.
So he had been around for a long time, and he just happened to set up shop in Utah. And because of that, we had a pretty deep well specifically for in jiu-jitsu. So my buddy found this guy, Will Bernalis, who came up under Pedro. He had his black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu from Pedro Sauer. And he also had a background in Muay Thai from the Thai Boxing Association under Master Chai.
And, okay.
Yeah, and also had links to Guru Dan, who I think you maybe got the interview. I can't remember exactly how that panned out.
No, I'm still working on getting the interview, but I got to train with him for a day.
That's
but
right.
I know he's touring the world doing all kinds of seminars, so I'm trying to be respectfully patient, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to get an interview from him too, because that man was an absolute wealth of information. That'd be a 4-hour podcast if I could keep him talking.
Yeah, for sure. I had an opportunity to be in front of him a couple times at a couple seminars and the Thai boxing annual camp. And like you said, the guy is amazing. He's such a wealth of information. I could just sit down and listen to him talk about whatever he wanted to talk about for hours and just try to gobble up as much information as I could. You know, the guy's amazing. So Will Bernalis, he had an impressive pedigree, and the guy's amazing. And he also does work in Cali, I'm a big believer in seeking out quality and learning from people that have really great reputations. I started training with him, and I trained with him for I am shit with time, James. It must have been probably 6-7 years that I was training with Will in mostly jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai. Not so much traditional like gi jiu-jitsu. We did some. I honestly wish I would have done more and hope to get back into it. I got my children in jiu-jitsu right now, and also training with Will Bernalis, which is really cool. I get to get on the mat and see my boy and my little girl do the stuff that I love, which is amazing. You know, that's what it's all about.
Absolutely.
It's not about me, you know, and my goals and my, what I want to do so much, you know, there's a point there that I need to take time for myself, but man, you know, I get way more, you know, I get a kick out of seeing my kids do the things that I love. You know, more so than I get out of doing it myself. So.
And how old are your kids?
My boy just turned 9, and my little girl is 5, and both of them do do jiu-jitsu, so it's pretty awesome.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think my little boy started when he was 5, and he's 9 right now. He's about to turn 10 this summer. So, I mean, I can't even describe the people out there what a martial art at that age will do to, you know, if they've got a good teacher, to a boy or a girl, seeing these little kids become these responsible, respectful children that can also, you know, I mean, really start to take care of themselves at a pretty young age.
Oh, for sure. It's amazing. You know, the values that you get taught in martial arts, you know, it's hard to get it nowadays in other avenues. You know, the things you learn about discipline and the things you learn about respect, and also humility. Like, you know, I think you actually mentioned this in one of your podcasts, is, you know, you can't have an ego and do jiu-jitsu or do those things, because, you know, ultimately you're gonna get shown that there's always someone bigger, someone stronger, and it's a good way to keep your ego in check.
Yeah, and I like the philosophy as well in jiu-jitsu, especially, where at the end of rolling, you know, you might have been, you know, roughhousing each other pretty hard, but at the end of it, you thank your partner for helping you become a better jiu-jitsu player, as opposed to some of the other sports where it's like crush them, destroy them, win. Yeah. The martial arts to me is, you know, you are each other's, you know, punch bag, really, or Wing Chun dummy, or whatever you want to call it. But at the end of it, there's that mutual respect that you've become a slightly better person and fighter through training with the person that you were competing against.
For sure. That's awesome. I mean, you know, you always get, every once in a while, you get those individuals that do have egos, and then they treat training like a fight, and it's, you know, that can be frustrating. And it's like, if you want to fight, man, go fight. Like, this is, we're here trying to improve ourselves. You know, this isn't the time to try to, you know, kill each other. And save that for the ring. If you want that, get in the ring and do it. You know,
careful what you wish for, though.
yeah. It's really cool. It's really cool to see the values that are taught in martial arts, and, you know, it's hard to get that in other places. You know, one of the things you don't get in martial arts as much is the teamwork aspect. And I also got my boy somehow persuaded to be interested in hockey, so he's kind of going down those lines right now too, and it's awesome. You know, there's really great things to learn in that field as well, and you know, how to function as a team and how that works. You know, the individual sports are great to show people that, you know, you're ultimately responsible, whether you succeed or fail. I mean, there's no one else to blame but you, but that doesn't always teach you how to function as a team too. You know, I kind of look at things that you definitely need both of those.
Yeah, I agree, especially in our career, that which we're going to get to in a little bit. So yeah. I'm going to fast forward. So you had a MMA career, a professional career, is that right? 3-0?
Yeah, it was professional, but it was also in small promotions, you know. It was kind of when it was on the big rise, and I mean, I had a pretty, you know, decent, if you'd call it a career. I was looking at taking it really serious. I actually tried out for the Ultimate Fighter a couple times. The first time went really, really well. I got through all the cuts, and then just didn't get selected. You know, it's a TV show. They're looking for character types, and that's kind of what told me.
Yeah.
So I didn't get selected, and then I went and tried out again, and that time went horribly wrong. I have a tendency to honest, like, a lot of the times I'm almost too relaxed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my second tryout went to shit. I came out, and we were in these big, you know, tryouts, there was like 1500 dudes there, you know, vouching for these spots, and I got there super early, you know, typical firefighter. I was like number 3 there, you know. I got there 4 hours earlier than it started, so I was in this first group to go, and during the grappling cuts, I was the first we were the first pair to go. So I didn't have any context, you know. And I had already been there. I was relaxed. And Dana White gets up and he gives his spiel like, oh, you know, we just want to see how you guys roll. Roll like you're rolling with your friend. You know, we don't want to see any heel hooks or anything. And I totally bought in hook, line, and sinker and came out way too passive. The dude was awesome. He like immediately got me on my back and all of a sudden we're playing the leg game and he throws my leg over and all I can think of is like, what are you doing? He just said no heel hooks and grabs my heel and just pops and pops my knee. And, you know, he immediately realized what he did. And, you know, it was just training, you know, you don't have time to think about those things. And, he heel hooked me and, my knee popped and he's like, sorry, sorry, sorry. And I'm like, no, let's just keep going. And I was trying to roll, but all I could think of is how, you know, sorry for my language, but how fucked up my knee was. And, you know, we finished the roll and, you know, obviously I didn't do too well and I got cut. I ended up tearing my MCL and my meniscus and luckily it didn't need surgery, but it was bad enough that, a month later, it might have not even been a whole month, but shortly thereafter, I had started, you know, I had already committed to pursuing firefighting, and I started the Fire Academy, you know, around a month after that happened. So I was still doing all the runs in a full-on knee brace and dealing with an MCL tear, and that was the point where I was like, well, shit, I don't know if these two passions are going to be as parallel as I'd hoped. So at that point I kind of took a step back with training, and just started working mostly in strength and conditioning and pursuing firefighting.
Okay. So while we're talking about the injuries, I know we wanted to touch on some other things. We'll get to an interesting profession you had prior to firefighting. I definitely want to talk about too. So tell me about how you rehabbed that knee, and then also you mentioned a back injury and a route that you've taken for that too.
Yeah. So the knee rehab, you know, I'll be honest, there wasn't anything structured. It was, you know, I went and got my knee checked out. The guy that checked it out, he told me I have it was pretty minor. It was a MCL tear and some meniscus tearing. But he concluded that it didn't need surgery, that I just needed a brace. And then, honestly, James, I don't even remember the details of what he told me. Like I said, it was a month later, and I had the academy, so I wasn't going to let that, you know, hold me back. So I just ran through it. I just worked through it with the brace on, and then slowly but surely recovered. Now, you know, I've had lots of injuries in my past, but I don't even I try to forget a lot of that. I don't even know which knee it was. You know, there's been enough injuries that I lose track. So there wasn't anything specific I did with the knee other than, you know, wear the brace and kind of keep moving. You know, keep everything from healing all. You know, tightened and I just kept moving, kept progressing. I also, my back, I was telling you, James, that I really enjoyed your podcast with, Dr. Eric Goodman, and what he had to say about, back rehab and keeping the individuals healthy. And it's awesome. You know, I've struggled with some back injuries and some back problems. And, you know, a lot of firefighters do, you know, well, not just firefighters. I mean, people in general, you know, it seems like the back's one of those things that, either, you know, hasn't evolved to the point where it needs to be, or, you know, we're kind of going backwards with as much sitting as we're doing, you know, which messes us up. But, when I was training to fight, that's when I noticed it the most. And one of the biggest things that contributed to it, that I could kind of point my finger at, it wasn't a super acute thing. There wasn't one individual injury that happened that was like, oh, that's what screwed my back. But those Muay Thai kicks, you know, that the way you would like really, throw your upper body as a counterbalance to against your hips to kind of keep you upright, you know, cause in a Muay Thai kick, you know, you're using your leg as like a baseball bat and you're trying to swing that leg and rotate those hips so hard and you're trying to counterbalance with your upper body. That's kind of that rotational,
torque.
Yeah. That torque on the spine is kind of what kept it flaring up. You know, it was really bad a few times, you know, to the point where, you know, I couldn't put on socks and was, you know, back injuries, they're horrible. You know, you can't find a comfortable position. You're in constant pain and the pain is so, it weighs on you so heavily. It's a pain, you know. Like I said, I've had my share of injuries, it's definitely one of the worst. I've broken ribs. I've lacerated my spleen, which, yeah, come to find out, internal bleeding's no joke. That back injury, it was really bad. I went and got an MRI. They told me I had the whole L5-S1 herniation. And I started down the chiropractic route. And just like anything, you know, I believe that there's good practitioners and there's bad practitioners. The chiropractor I went, it didn't feel like it helped me at all. In fact, it felt like it was making me worse.
Right.
Yeah. So at that same time, I was getting more involved into strength and conditioning and kind of just furthering my knowledge in that aspect. And I started doing more hinging movements and trying to elongate that posterior chain. You know, my hamstrings chronically tight, trying to lengthen all that musculature out to relieve that tension. Along those same lines, I there's a guy that was in the same circles as me, and he's I don't know if you've ever heard of structural integration. Or Rolfing, have you heard of those?
Rolfing sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's just they're the same thing. It just kind of depends on what kind of school you came up in. But Rolfing is named after kind of the lady that engineered or came up with it. Her name was Ida Rolf, and it's a type of body work, and it's very deep, very intense body work. They're really focused on fascia and the connective tissue, not so much the musculature. You know, they'll address knots in the muscle, but they're really after that connective tissue,
right?
And that fascia. And I started doing research, and I went and saw him. His name's Ryan Higgison. He's a guy locally here that is amazing. You know, I really credit him to keeping me healthy. He's done amazing things. Fundamentally, what I think happens to me, and this is my specific issue, this, you know, may not work for everybody, but, you know, there's the trauma there. There's the issue in the back. There's the bulging disc or the herniation, and that hits on that nerve, and it seizes everything up. And, you know, you probably know this better than I do, but the body, you know, wants to splint that injury. So everything just, with me specifically, just tightens right the hell up around that injury. And everything is just rock solid and super tight. And if I can go in and see him and he can manually get those things to release and open up, you know, it's amazing. I'll go walk into him. You know, I tweak my back every once in a while now. You know, the things I do, it's not like, I'm just baking cookies. I'll tweak my back and I'll go into him not being able to stand upright, you know, and feeling a lot of pain. and he'll open me up, and I'll be able to walk out of there, and I can still feel the injury, but it's not debilitating, and in fact, like I can carry on, I can train. You know, there was a time I was in a deadlifting program, and I tweaked my back, and I got right on it, started doing my kind of PT program that I do for it, and saw him and was able to pick up like the next week. You know, it's pretty amazing. I don't think that type of work is as popular because, you know, one, you can't run it through your insurance. So that's going to be a limiting factor. And then two, it's not, you know, it's definitely not very pleasant while you're getting it done. Yeah. I kind of enjoy it. You know, there's times he'll get my psoas from the front of my body. And I always joke with him, I feel almost like William Wallace on the table. I want to yell out freedom. And I feel like his hands are like literally in my guts. You know what I mean? Like it's deep work.
That was a beautiful story about how an Australian saved all those Scottish people.
It's really great work. You know, he's worked on some pretty notable athletes, and the people that go see him, you know, if you can deal with some, you know, I'm willing to deal with some temporary pain to come out better on the other side. And that's what it boils down to. I think too many people are too quick to mask the problem with medication, or, you know, a lot of physicians will, you know, it's hard to see things like fascia, you know, that doesn't show up on an x-ray or an MRI, and that can be a contributing factor, but, you know, they see that bulging disc and their line of attack is let's go in there and shave that off, which some people may need that, but I'll always err and I always try to recommend people to go from the least invasive to the most. You know, if you've done everything you can, then get cut open and get shaved. But that's like my last ditch effort. I'll do anything I can to keep that from happening.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. That's why I went the chiropractic and foundation training route that I did, and using CrossFit to strengthen my back. And, you know, here I am now testifying with no scars in my back, and it worked phenomenally. So, and the fascia release work is not an area that I've used that much, apart from the lacrosse balls and rolling and that kind of thing. But I did have a shiatsu massage in Japan, which is probably pretty much the same thing. And that was agonizing as well. So, yeah, it was like I felt more like I was listening to a Justin Bieber album. It was that kind of pain. So...
Yeah, anything but that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was, you know, that was pretty horrendous. All right, so let's kind of steer this towards your entry to the fire school then, or the fire community. So just educate me for a moment. Had you joined Jim Jones by then?
Yeah, so that was around that same lines. I got invited to be involved with Jim Jones. It was like late 2007, 2008-ish. It was back when it was right after. So I don't know if, you know, we've talked a bit, but Jim Jones and Mark Twight and the people that were involved in it, they worked on, you know, the 300 movie, which blew up. Before 300, it was just a very small gym with a group of fighters and a group of climbers that were training there. And Mark had the opportunity to work with the cast of 300, and you know that movie changed kind of the landscape of physical training. You know, honestly, it was the first movie that there wasn't just one, you know, main, you know, the star that was in good shape, but it was like the whole cast.
Yeah.
So it was very impactful. Had a big effect, and the gym got a lot of notoriety and getting the big reputation really quick. And I kind of came in right before that flood. So when I came in, it was still just, you know, fairly small. There was a group of us fighters that would train on Tuesday and Thursdays, and then some climbers, and not much more than that. There was some, if I remember right, there was some outside, there was like one IT company that was doing a little team development thing during that time as well, but it was fairly small.
Okay, and what was it that made the people behind the film come to your gym specifically?
You know, I think it, Lisa Beauchard, who was Lisa Twite at the time, she had some relationships with some of the people. I think Zack Snyder, and I think that's exactly how it kind of got linked up, was there was, you know, some relationship there. Mark had been doing a lot. I mean, he was, you know, he's a world renowned climber. He already had a great reputation. They were doing some stuff with the military, already. And they were also, he was a self-made, you know, fitness guru, so to speak. He did a lot of his own research and came to a lot of conclusions. And his drive was to get himself in the best shape he could to climb. And you know, that was a life and death situation. So his fitness, was imperative. You know, it's just similar to firefighters. I mean, our fitness can mean the difference between whether we live and die. And it was the same for him, and it was directly related. So, you know, granted, he put a lot of effort into getting in the best shape as he could. And that's kind of how that movie, the relationship with like the DC films kind of came to be as far as my knowledge is.
Okay. And obviously we're going to delve into your program, so I'm not going to ask you to go into too much detail on this, but what was it about the programming that separated the Jim Jones philosophy from a lot of the other gyms around at that time?
Yeah. You know, I get that question a lot. You know, one of the first things that I always get asked is like, what's the difference between Jim Jones and CrossFit? And on paper from the outside, it's really similar. You know, we do a lot of the same movements, it's like same metabolic type efforts, and you know, it's kind of similar, but Jim Jones, what drew me to it, is the philosophy that the mind is primary, and the niche there is the Jim Jones. We would use the physical realm. Just almost the end goal is the psychological training that happens, and the physicality and the fitness we use is just a means kind of to that end, so to speak. So it was that, that we're really focusing on training the mind, by using, the physical nature. And, also one of the things that I liked to me personally, like one of my, philosophies is that, you know, I'm a quality over quantity type person. And that's kind of the same thing, you know, the type of training that we do isn't as big as like groups as a lot of CrossFit classes, you know, which is fine. You can just handle those a different way. You know, we try to keep, you know, I personally try to keep my group sessions around, you know, a cap of seven. You know, it's kind of like a span of control that we learn in, you know, firefighting is like 5 to 7 individuals. If you get outside of that, you can't maintain, you know, enough attention to the individuals and kind of see what needs to happen. So that's kind of and then also, you know, we don't necessarily define fitness for everybody. You know, CrossFit is great, and I you know, I recommend a lot of firefighters. I mean, it fits our job description really well. I mean, the job description and the physical attributes that are needed in firefighting is very general physical preparedness. You know, I mean, it's along those same lines. It works really well for military, assets. It works really well for firefighters. And also the general public, you know, it's great. There's a reason why it's so popular. But also, you know, that doesn't mean it's for everybody. If you want to be, you know, a great cyclist, you're a specific athlete, so you need specific training. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It does. It does indeed. It's interesting. Right around the same time, my gym owner just went to the CrossFit Level 2 cert. I was at the TSAC, the NSCA Tactical Strength and Conditioning conference last week with my trainers from Reedy Creek. And the theme is heavily on two things: overtraining, which I wish I could say that fire departments, that was the main problem, but obviously that's a small percentage that are overtraining. But the other one was programming and understanding, obviously, you know, why you're doing certain things. And CrossFit has been a big push, it appears, in CrossFit to go back to what was the original programming, which was focusing on just that one thing per session and getting away from the programming for the competitive athletes that were having to learn all these different movements and, you know, lift crazy weights, but back to, as you said, being strong and fit enough to do your job, do your sport, whatever it is that you love. So we're back to pretty much the main site programming now in our gym, and then building all the accessory work and that stuff around it, but putting more emphasis back in the coaching and less from trying to fill every minute of that hour with exercise.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny how things evolve and things come full circle. You know, I'm actually no longer a part of Jim Jones. I'm branching out and I'm doing my own thing. And it's kind of interesting how things come full circle, and the reasons that this is starting, that I'm starting my own thing, is the original kind of reasons that Jim Jones started in the first place, you know. And it's funny how, you know, you see this consistently throughout history, is like the circle that happens. You know, we'll get to a certain point and then learn, oh, you know, maybe that's not the way to go about things. Let's start over and go get back to the root, back to the foundation, and then go again. And, you know, we learn as we go, we evolve. The trick is, you know, always evolving, never arriving. You know, the minute you think you've arrived, you might as well just dig your grave and lay in it, because you stop learning, you're dying. You know, that's, I always am trying to learn. I'm always trying to look to new avenues to open my kind of my viewpoints and look outside of the box and take a step back and really look at things. And, you know, you've talked about it in some of your previous podcasts, but the whole, you know, Bruce Lee mantra of use what's useful, discard what's useless. You know, I kind of live by that methodology or that method. And that's kind of how I approach things. And it's interesting to see how things evolve over time.
Yeah, and we will delve into that, but you just gave me the world's best segue. So what do you know about digging graves, Paul?
Oh, I know quite a bit about digging graves. My whole professional career, ever since I started working, which, you know, I started working as a sophomore in high school during summers, has all been centered around service. I started mowing lawns for the city that I grew up in, and that progressed into, you know, ultimately, you know, having a little landscape crew, and I'd go around and mow the municipal parks and things like that. And then it just kept progressing. And you know, one thing that I am is I'm loyal. You know, I'm a loyal individual, and sometimes to a fault. But you know, I was doing things, you know, I was playing it. You know, I always was driven to this whole kind of idea of service, and I knew that that's kind of what I wanted to do. But honestly, I wasn't following my passions. You know, I was just doing things to do them. I just kind of fell into these roles, and that ultimately ended up with me falling into the role as my title was cemetery sexton, which is kind of an old world term. It essentially means I managed two cemeteries. I opened and closed graves. I met with families, you know, that had recently lost a loved one, and set up the funeral service. Not the specifics I shouldn't say funeral service, but the graveside service and the opening and closing of the grave. I'd sell cemetery plots, and I'd open and close graves, and I was in charge of the grounds, and it was pretty interesting. I learned a lot, you know as well, you know, we're in professions that we're surrounded by death. And that job was definitely wasn't easy. You know, in the fire service, we have our crew, we have our structure, our group that we all experience these, you know, things together. In that avenue it was harder. You know, I didn't see death as the way we see it now is like right when it happens. But honestly, I don't know for you, but some of the hardest things is not seeing death as in the individuals that have died. I mean, that can be extremely difficult. Don't get me wrong. You know, especially if it's children, you know, now that I have children, that's the hardest thing. But seeing the families, you know, that's seeing how they're affected. That was hard. And I would deal with that stuff on a routine basis daily. And, you know, you can always look at things at the negative side of things, or you can look at it, you know, at the positives. You know, I look at that and, you know, I'm an extremely humble individual, and I realize that no matter how good you might have it, it might be gone tomorrow. You know, I truly try to live every day as if, you know, it kind of sounds like cliche and some country song or something, but, you know, try to live every day like it's your last, because you never know. I buried a lot of people, seen a lot of people die, and it doesn't matter your age, it doesn't matter your status, it can happen to anybody, you know, and that's kind of the core of my belief system, is like, you know, you never know what's going to happen, so you might as well shoot for the stars and give it all you got.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's interesting what you're saying about that whole thing. Two things. Firstly, I remember a very specific incident. I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast before. I apologize to the listeners if you heard this, but very long story short, I had a gentleman in his mid-20s drop dead with an aneurysm. Yeah. And the way the hospital was laid out at that point, I worked, I was kind of leading the call. My crew and I worked him, got him to the hospital. He didn't make it, obviously. And then where they had us doing the reports was literally about 6 feet from the grieving room. And again, it was tragic this young man had died. But what was 10 times as hard was, again, seeing the effects. I mean, this is just one of, you know, hundreds of calls that we've had this. But seeing the hearts wrenched out of the people that are left behind, whether it's a suicide or, you know, something like this, a medical or an accident, but just the trauma. So I can see that. And then on some of the work I did on the PTSD side, the Dark Side Project, and even a lot of the feedback on some of the blog posts I wrote, people that were reaching out were obviously police, EMS, fire, military, but then, you know, medical examiners and all these other fields, you know, ER nurses and doctors and people that you don't think of as much. But as you touched on, I kind of want to underline this, in the military, in especially fire, you know, we have that group, that tribe. And I had Sebastian Junger on earlier in the show. And I love that whole philosophy. But yeah, yourself, the medical examiner, those people don't have those other crew members to decompress. And I think the same thing happens when we're in a crew and then one of us gets hurt and now all of a sudden we're on our own. I think you see that a lot. I'm going to have a guest, Mick from Australia, who has a clinic there. He's a police officer, but they deal parallel with mental and physical trauma. And I asked him during the conference, he was at TSAC, do you see the mental symptoms manifest when you get your guys with the physical injuries? And he said, yeah, there's a gap of a few weeks and all of a sudden you see all that crap just pouring out. So, yeah. You know, I can see how it would be worse as a grave digger, as a mortician, as a CSI photographer than for us, in the way that we at least have that group when it's intact to share the pain with.
Yeah. You know, and like that whole thing too, you know, I went from I really want to make a difference. Like that's my driving principle. I really want to make a difference. And, you know, in the, as the cemetery sexton, it was all, I could make it as smooth as I could. But it's, you know, that's a reactive response, you know, and fire, you know, I look at that as being, you know, more of a proactive trying to deal anything I can to keep that shit from happening before it happens.
All right. Well, let's transition back to exactly that. So with our own people, you have teamed up with John Spira from Fit to Fight Fire. He was on the show earlier as well. And as you said, you've branched out now. So tell me about your new company you formed, and then we'll delve into your programming for that.
Yeah. I'm starting my own gym. Well, I shouldn't say my own. I've got an amazing team behind me, and we're getting some really cool stuff off the ground, and it's been amazing how fast we've been able to make it happen. But the new project's called The Sect, S-E-C-T, and we're doing some really cool stuff. We're going to have an amazing facility for people to come and to train. And, you know, with John, I honestly can't remember who reached out to who, because it's been an eventful few weeks, to say the least, James. But I paired up with John with Fit to Fight Fire and offering physical programming through his website. You know, along those same lines, I'm trying to take the things that I've learned throughout the years in strength and conditioning, and especially that niche of, you know, call it whatever you want, call it mental toughness, call it grit, call it perseverance, you know, whatever the hell you want to call it. That's kind of where, you know, I feel like my niche is. And building a program that one will hopefully get our brothers and sisters in better shape physically, but also better shape mentally to do our job, you know. And along those same lines, you know, I used to love strength and conditioning and you know, working out when it was just picking shit up and putting it down. But the more I learn about it and the things you learn, and when you talk about PTSD and, you know, that's my one. I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned and things you can do to make you more mentally tough. And it's not being about, you know, PTSD is not being, you know, mentally tough. I don't mean to say that, but I use that as a way to work things out. You know, there's something to be said about, you know, I've tried meditating. I do a little bit of things. I follow I really enjoy like Sam Harris, guys like that. And I've tried meditating, but I don't get as much out of it. As you know, I'm a physical, like I need to do something. And if I can get into like a workout that honestly is so hard that literally everything else just fades away. You know what I mean? You can't think about what's going on, you know, in your personal life or what's going on at work. It's just a time to, all you can think about is like getting through the work. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Well, it boils back to being present. I mean, that's the yeah. thing that we're fighting so much with cell phones and, you know, all the contraptions we have around us is, it's so hard now. And I am 100% just as guilty as the next person. I grab my phone and check, oh, you know, how many listens have we had the podcast? Who was like the Instagram post, you know? And then I have to literally like put my phone in another room because we have so many. But yeah, when I'm working out, you know, I have a whole, I consider myself a pretty happy-go-lucky person. But if I'm in that place, then I look like I'm ready to smack someone in the face because that's my zone where I go and like, just like you said, forget about everything and just try and suffer through whatever god-awful workout or program.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I don't claim to be the most mentally tough individual out there. You know, we all have our good days and our bad days, but, you know, I feel like I definitely know some good ways to push that threshold and to get stronger in that realm. You know, you take things as simple as a static hold. You know, that's one of the tools that I use a lot is, you know, we call it like forward leaning rest or front leaning rest. It's kind of a military term. But FLR, you know, whatever plank, whatever you want to call it, top of the push-up position. You take something like that and you just put someone under that and you say, okay, hold as long as you can. Do an FLR until failure. You know, and there's guys that can do it for hours and hours, you know, and it's proof. Like, that is such a mentally tough thing to do because, I mean, you're not going to fail a front-leaning rest because of your physical capability. You know, it's mental. It's totally mental. I stop because I'm mentally weak. I don't stop because my body can't hold myself up. I stop because it's uncomfortable and I give up. So it's a great way, is something as simple as that, to just train yourself, you know, in that mental aspect.
All right. Well, touching on that. So you, correct me if I'm wrong, the programs that you sent me, it looked like they were divided into, I'm sure there are levels as well, but you had crew, gear, and no gear. So firstly, tell me about how you partitioned all those different modalities.
Yeah, you know, it's tough whenever you're putting out a general program. You know, the more general the program, the less effective it is by nature. You know, if you try to put out a program to fit the vast majority, you know, it doesn't take into account someone's specific limitations or weaknesses. It's just a general program. But with that, you know, I tried to look at it and tried to put something together that'll help, you know, how I see helping, you know, our brothers and sisters the best I can. You know, it's a general program. The three options that are currently being offered on John's site are a foundation a foundation plan that's either an individual based program, meaning, you know, one person can grab it, print it out, and it's basically a month long program. And they can look at each day and the work's laid out for them. And also recovery days are in there and rest days are in there. A lot of people try to do too much, you know, and don't give the body the rest and recovery it needs. And end up plateauing for that reason. But anyway, it's foundational. There's nothing on there that shouldn't be too difficult. I've had a lot of questions as far as like what you need. The foundation programs are kind of written along of a gym, like a CrossFit gym, like what you would have access at a CrossFit gym. Or, you know, what you would call a functional training gym. You know, there's barbell stuff, there's some kettlebell stuff, there's rowers, bikes, but there's also, I built it so there's also some leniency and some options there. You know, on the cardiovascular base days, you know, it could be on a rower, it could be out on a run, it could be on a bike, it could be in a pool, you know. Yeah. I tried to keep it as general as I could. And then the crew is essentially the same program, just built more around working out as a crew, which I highly recommend if you can, you know.
Absolutely.
There's so many good things that come out of that. Just working together with a crew. You know, I just yesterday, I got an opportunity to see Jocko Willink and talk to him. And, you know, one of the things he contributes to building a strong team is working together, you know, and I completely agree. I've seen it time and time again. You know, it's amazing the bonds that can develop through suffering, you know, and I say suffering, and I do mean that. I kind of have went back and forth with that term. But suffering, you know, I've read articles that have done studies where people have sat down for a meal and, you know, there was a control group and a test group. And the control group just ate a normal meal, and the test group ate a meal that was like really spicy. And there was like some sort of group suffering, you know what I mean? As simple as eating some really spicy food. And after the fact, that group that ate the spicy food was, you know, they did a little questionnaire. And after that, the group was willing to do more for those individuals that they quote unquote suffered with, you know.
Yeah.
There's a huge thing, and they call it, you know, in our field, and, you know, they call it the brotherhood, the sisterhood, you know, we're a family, and there's some of that suffering already in place. You know, we go on these shitty calls, you know, we see something that's bad, you know, we see some kid, you know, that suffered some horrible accident. We've suffered together, and there's a reason that they call the fire service, you know, a brotherhood and a sisterhood. Same with military, you know, they're so tight because, you know, I attribute a lot of it to that whole suffering, you know. And it can come down to the actual job of like seeing things on calls and dealing with shit in that aspect. And it can also, you know, in my opinion, it can be, you know, suffering through, you know, something crucible like a workout together, you know, and learning to rely on one another to get you through some sort of work. I think that's huge. And it's hard to quantify that stuff on paper, you know, but I think it's gigantic. And I highly recommend, if you can, like, get the crew together and work out as a crew, you know, that's the way to go. But, you know, I also realize that sometimes you don't have opportunities to work out while you're at the station. Or maybe you're on a crew that you can't get anyone to join you, so, you know, you can do the individual stuff as well, and at least you're going to better yourself.
Yeah, and definitely, ideally, having your whole crew, there's no question. I think there's two ways in today's fire department where we're not, you know, burning down buildings every day, like the glory years, is training. Like, we just did RIT training in my department, and it was phenomenal. I mean, it was a three-bottle evolution. We had two teams that kind of alternated, and it was an ass kicker. But at the end of it, you know, you could just sense how everyone was kind of drawn a little bit closer. And then the other thing, just like you said, a good hard workout where you guys go through the same thing. It can be scaled, so everyone could be doing their own version of it. But
yeah,
the suffering is kind of the same. There's no question that when you're all lying on the floor at the end, you know, that you've bonded a little bit more. The dining room table, you know, eating together, all those little things in today's fire service where some departments are hiring 18 in a heartbeat and that brotherhood isn't fostered. That's how you, in my opinion, bring your firehouse back to the way it was, you know, the way we perceive it, the way it should be.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree.
All right. So then, touching on gear. So, not trying to hit any nerves, but let me be very politically correct. We have a spectrum of videos on social media from people working out in gym gear all the way through to people doing muscle ups and all kinds of crazy movements in full gear, SCBA, the whole works.
Yeah.
I'll give you my opinion first, so that way I'm not dumping it all on you. There's a happy medium, and I think you need to do firefighter specific movements. I did one with dragging sleds and pushing sleds a few weeks ago with some of my guys. I think that's kind of the area where you can work with that. So what's your opinion? And it's just an opinion. I mean, not saying other people are wrong, but what's your view? Because I know you have a gear and no gear. What's your view on where that line is putting your gear on?
Yeah, for sure. Just to clarify, the gear and the no gear workouts or the programs, that's specifically talking about like fitness equipment gear, not necessarily turnouts.
Okay.
The no gear is meaning like just if you don't have access to like a gym, you know, it's a body weight based fitness program. So just to clarify, that's what that
okay means. But the question still stands.
Oh, for sure. So that I could probably clarify that. As far as working out in gear, you know, I don't think it has to be done all the time. Especially like if you're on a crew that actually trains in your gear, that's all you need, in my opinion. The whole intent there, for the way I see it, my personal opinion, is you need to be just like any fitness program or any physical program. You need to be acclimatized to what you're going to experience, you know, and there's the whole mentality and the thought process of training how you fight is legit. You know, if you haven't put on your gear in months, you haven't strapped on a bottle and you haven't breathed through it, and then all of a sudden you get a working job and you get a fire, and you haven't done that, and you're not acclimatized to it, you're not conditioned to it, you know, it's kind of a big deal. So I don't think it's condoned or needed all the time, but it really depends. You know, I hate the answer with it depends, but the more you learn, that's always the answer, right? It depends on how often you're in your gear on a routine basis. If you're getting fires all the time, by all means, just train in your normal PT shorts and t-shirt. The way I wrote those programs is one day a week you would put on, well, it's quote unquote recommended that you put on gear and go through some sort of training. And it's usually the way I kind of wrote it, it's just the last kind of conditioning portion of the program. And it's like once a week you put on gear. And, you know, with that, with the studies of cancer, you know, if you don't have spare turnouts, like I don't believe that we should be putting on our turnouts that are, or wearing them on a regular basis that are, you know, always smell of smoke. And, you know, that's not condoned either. But, like I said, it, if you are not conditioned to it, you know, in my opinion, it's a big deal. I've done some really cool stuff, and it doesn't always have to be in your whole, like, all your turnouts and on air, but man, you want some valuable data, just throw on your pack and your bottle, and make sure your bottle's topped off. I don't know if you were on like a 45 minute bottle, but make sure it's topped off, make sure that starting point is consistent, and then I call it as much work as possible. So what is that? AMWAP? I don't know. But whatever it is, you know, put on a bottle, sit on a rower or whatever, and see how far you can get. You know, you get a lot of valuable information of, I mean, you talk about VO2 max and, you know, coming up with those numbers. And man, like if I put on a bottle and I just row and see how many meters I can get before I bust my seal, there's a shitload of information right there. How effective I am, how my power to weight ratio has an effect on how efficient I am, because I'm going a set amount of distance on a set amount of breathing air. So, I mean, there's a lot of good information there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, especially, I think the most pertinent thing you said, bring that all together, is if you're a Detroit FD, you probably don't need to put your gear on. If you're like my department, where, you know, we have this super aggressive sprinkler policy all over Disney, which is basically what we protect, we do not get a lot of fire. I had a lot of fire in my other departments, and thank goodness. So I brought that experience with me. But it's very important for us to do that, and to kind of add to the whole you shouldn't work out in your gear because of the carcinogens. Obviously, if you put it through an extractor and you get it cleaned, that would be a good time to do it. And then the other thing is we just rotated through some of our gear. So some of the stuff that's 10 years old has been taken out of commission. Well, that's the perfect gear to see if your department has that you can take for working out now. You're not going to go in any structure fires. It wouldn't be your official second set. But see if you can find an old jacket and a pair of pants, and that can be your workout set that you throw on. You know, that way, when you get a real fire, your gear isn't soaked with sweat as well.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I did. Is I sought out an old, you know, my department. You know, I'm sure all of us, you know, we all battle the same things. You know, budget constraints and things like that. It's not like we have extra pairs of turnouts, you know. But I sought out an old pair of turnouts, and I have a training pair of turnouts that I keep, well, quote unquote, clean. You know, they're sweaty, you know, but they haven't been in fire, at least, you know, like they've went through a pretty stringent cleaning process. I still clean them on a regular basis, but those aren't my frontline turnouts. And it's just like I was saying, like you have to be conditioned, you know, you take even something like, you know, for example, you do a fitness program and you get in better, quote unquote, shape than you have been in years. But let's say you haven't stepped on a rower for months. You're not conditioned to it, you know, and it's a new stimulus you're not conditioned to. And if you're not conditioned to it, you're not going to perform as well, despite how even if you on paper are in better physical condition.
Yeah. And also the other element as well, sorry to interrupt, but that we've seen with our department is if you're not putting that gear on, you're getting people that thought they were fine in their masks, that thought they were fine in confined spaces, that thought they were okay climbing the aerial. And all of a sudden, now they realize they're not. Now, you know, God forbid that someone's life is in the balance and they just realize that then they rip the mask off in the middle of a fire. So this is a great way of holding a mirror up to yourself and then realizing where you need to work on in a safe environment before the same thing happens in an environment that might take your life.
For sure. That's one of my big kind of personal pet peeves too, is like the training environment is controlled. You know, there's risk in everything we do, but if something's going to happen, you know, I would rather it happen in a controlled environment where, you know, I can pop my mask. I'm not going to die. You know, I did something the other day. I got on the rower and put my mask on, and we did a little crew relay on it. And I came out the gate hard. You know, I have a tendency to do that sometimes, despite, you know, my knowledge of knowing that that's not always the best thing to do. I have a hard time pacing myself. And I came out hard and I got off and I had that panic breathing and I almost cracked my mask and I was in the damn PT room, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? But, and if I can build that threshold and then like calm myself down and realize, oh shit, you know, the goal of this workout is to make this bottle last as long as I can. And I've just burned through, you know, 300 PSI, you know, I'm failing, you know, and that's some good information to have, because if you take that same thing and you put it in a IDLH environment, you're asking for problems, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's not dramatic. It's not Hollywood when we say, you know, lives depend on us, because they do, you know, your own life and then your brothers and sisters, if you go down, and then obviously the people that you initially were going in to get. So I think, you know, we have to kind of remind ourselves that it's not some cliche, god-awful, cheesy firefighter t-shirt, but it is actually a real statement as well. You know, lives really do hang in the balance, and our training and our fitness can literally save or take a life.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's the same thing. It's easy. You know, it sounds like our departments are similar. You know, we don't go on fires every day or every week, you know, but you know, in our job, it can be easy to get complacent. And, you know, I want to be at war with complacency. You know, I want to do everything I can to not get complacent. And also to encourage, you know, our brothers and sisters to do the same thing, because like you said, even if it hasn't happened shit in your career, it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. It's still out there. It's still a possibility. And like you say, and like John Sparrow says, is like, how would you feel if there is something shitty that happened and it could have been completely prevented if you were in a better physical condition? You know, I mean, that's something that I have complete control over. You know, I don't have control over what happens in the structure. I don't have control over what happens with even administration, you know, or there's so many things in the world that I don't have complete control over, but my physical capability, how fit I am to be a firefighter, that is fucking right in my wheelhouse. I have complete control over that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, exactly. It's the same as the testing process that we go through to become a firefighter. I always tell guys that are testing, I'm like, you better rock the physical test and the written test, because those two, you own those. The interview, obviously, that's now down to perception. You can practice it, but if some guy, you know, was expecting a different answer, now you're in a different realm. But there's a wrong answer and a right answer on the written test, and there's either a great performance or a shit performance in the physical test, and you own those two portions.
For sure. Yeah, you're in complete control of that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have been chatting for a long time, so I'm going to start curving us into some of the shorter questions.
You know, what's funny, James, is I am not a talker. You know, this is totally outside my realm, but it's funny. Like, I've done a couple podcasts, and this happens. You know, I can talk for days on this stuff, you know, and I really appreciate your time too, James.
Well, no, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, I love this stuff, and to me, having, you know, yourself and all these other people, some of whom have written books and done TV shows, but this hour and a half conversation just teases out so many, you know, nuggets, and it's seeds. You know, we're not gonna solve the world's problems in an hour and a half, but if it gets people thinking, it gets people opening a website or a book or, you know, your programming or whatever it is. That's what I love about this whole podcast world. So, the fact that, you know, you're able to tell us your story is, you know, truly appreciated.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. So, actually I'm going to totally go back against what I said, because I got one more question that might open a little bit more dialogue.
Let's do it.
What is your view on training on shift? Because surely if I work out on shift, then I'm going to be so tired, I'm going to be unable to do anything if I get a call. That was sarcasm.
Yeah. you know, I like training on shift. I've even got access to, you know, now I'm going to have access to my own gym. But back to those lines of training as a group, training as a crew, I think that is huge. You know, it's all about, for me, I'm a probability guy. It's all about a probability. And, you know, if I do something really hard with the crew and we're all exhausted and a fire comes in, you know, that's not ideal, but, neither's the other option. If I'm on crew, you know, most of us in the fire service have a PT room. And you don't even need a PT room, but, you have your crew, you know, and if you train as a crew, that bonding and everything that's happened, that everything that happens, that's huge, you know? So, I really enjoy it. I would suggest it. It comes down to that probability, and I've been on crews, like, you know, I would rather be on a crew that works out, that trains hard during the day. And if a fire comes in, I mean, you know, the fires come in, and honestly, a lot of times I feel like we would be better suited and fit to handle those scenarios if they came up, even if we were exhausted, than the person that just sits all day in the recliner, you know? So that's kind of how I feel about it. In an ideal world, which we, you know, none of us live in an ideal world, you'd get your crew and right after you get off shift or something, you all go to a awesome gym and you can get through it and you don't have to do it while you're on shift. And, but you know, we don't live in an ideal world. And for me, like I said, it's about that probability, and I'd rather be on a crew that works out on shift, and is bettering ourselves. And, you know, overall, we're in better condition to when those fires come in. And, you know, it's all about probability.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I went to, I think it was the NSCA conference last year, and they had a TSAT component, and a gentleman did a presentation on exactly that. Crews working out on shift versus not working out on shift. And obviously there was a sedentary component then, and it basically equated to, even if you were fatigued, if you were in shape, you still outperformed the guys that weren't working out that were completely fresh. So as I said, and I think John's even quoted me on his site, you know, what happens if you get a call and you'll be the fittest firefighter on the fire ground?
That's
it, you know. So, I mean, you shouldn't, by the time you drive to wherever you're going, you should have pretty much recovered from whatever you were doing anyway. So I back up your statement there.
Awesome.
All right, so back to our very short questions then. So firstly, I always ask people, is there a film and or a book that you recommend to people?
A film.
Film or documentary?
Documentary. There was a really cool one, kind of getting back to that hockey stuff. There was a really cool one that I watched a while back. It was called The Last Gladiators, which is about basically hockey enforcers, primarily Chris Nyland. And it was really awesome, like how they portrayed and how they show, you know, what those enforcers do for the organization. And they're easily dismayed. People don't recognize it. You know, you get called a goon, you get called this, which, you know, they're not, they don't have the skills that a lot of the other players do, but shit, talk about heart, man. Those guys have heart, and it's amazing what they'll put their bodies through for their organization because their love for it. And that was really cool. And that's one that, you know, probably not too many people have seen that I would recommend. As far as books go, Dan, like I try to read or listen to books as much as I can. There's been a lot of great ones lately. I was just saying that had an opportunity yesterday to go see Jocko Willink, and his book Extreme Ownership was awesome. Him in person was even better, you know, better than the book. I'm really digging Ryan Holiday as of late. He's really big on like Stoic philosophy. So books like Obstacle is the Way and Ego is the Enemy, they're both amazing. You know, some of that stuff, that's how I have a tendency to think that way anyway. So it's kind of self-affirming, which, you know, might not be the best thing. You know, I should probably get outside of my, you know, expand my horizons and look in other areas. But those two were great. Angela Duckworth with Grit, that was a great book. I mean, it's hard for me to limit. It kind of depends on what people are after. You know, I don't read for entertainment value. I read for purely just to expand. You know, it's hard for me. I can't pick up a book. I don't know if I've ever read a novel, but I can read a textbook. It's kind of odd.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few people in our field, or even really just a common thread in our guests, that are very much like that. And even Tim Ferriss, the people he has on, the books that they've written tend to be the ones that I gravitate towards. And they're usually, you know, they're not fiction. They might use a storytelling framework to tell, just like Jocko does, I mean, each chapter begins with one of their missions, but again, it's not fiction, it's still factually based.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so what do you do to decompress? Obviously, you exercise, we're fully aware of that. So apart from your sport, is there anything else? And you did mention meditation as well. Any other areas that you use?
I think you've talked about it a lot on your podcast. For me, my family is everything. That's, if I had to look at myself and kind of define who I am, is I'm a family man. That's who I am at my core. And spending time with my family is, that's everything to me. But I think that's really common. That's, again, kind of goes along with the type of personalities that are involved in the services we are. That's kind of who we are. Aside from spending time with my family, I've got an amazing wife and two amazing children. I've got a dirt bike that I'm getting back into. And I try to get out on that every once in a while and get on some single track and up into the mountains here in Salt Lake. It's just amazing. So that's probably the one thing that I've been doing as of late that's, specifically, I think it's important that people do something specifically for them, have something, do something that's for you. Fitness used to be my thing to fill that kind of void, and it still is to a certain extent, but now that's my profession as well. So I don't get all the same attributes or the benefits from it that I used to. So, I really condone people having something, something for them specifically, to get out and do to decompress. And that's probably the thing I've been gravitating towards, the most lately is getting out on my dirt bike and getting on some awesome single track and just, something to be said about getting out in nature too, and being out and, miles away from quote unquote civilization is pretty empowering, pretty cool.
Very cool. Yeah, I haven't heard that one yet, so that's a new one on the bike. But again, I think it's a common thread that everyone has that passion. I think I've touched on this too, using that fitness that you've got to do the thing that you love. So that's awesome. All right, so the last one is, where can people find you and your work online, on social media, all those other areas?
Awesome, thanks, James. We're just getting a kind of the website foundation kind of built in the process now. That's gonna be likely at thesectfitness.com. But right now, probably the best way to find me is through social media. I'm kind of a funny guy. There's a lot of things about social media that I truly have a hard time with, but it's amazing. The power that, I wouldn't be talking to you if it wasn't for social media. So there's some really great things that come through it, and I'm trying to, be more active on it, as time progresses. You can find me on Instagram at Paul_G_Roberts, or my the fitness the sect Instagram, which is at the sect fitness. And then I use just primarily Instagram to feed things like Facebook and Twitter. You can kind of find me on both of those at either my name or the sect fitness. So that's kind of where I can be found right now.
Okay, and I'm going to add one more thing to our listeners. So Jocko Willink would also be a phenomenal guest. I reached out to him a couple of times, but I understand he is in high demand and I'm sure extremely busy. But feel free to flood him with emails, Twitter posts, Instagram posts, how he would be a vital component to the first responders of the world. And let's see if we can get him, use social media to get him on this show too.
There you go. Yeah, he'd be awesome. He's so cool. Like I said, I really enjoyed his book, but man, being in person, and just talking to him was awesome. And it was a small event, so there was a lot of quite a bit of time just talking to him one-on-one, and it was really cool. You know, I think we gravitate towards those individuals that, you know, I try to learn something from everybody. You know, I try to learn everyone I encounter. There's something to be learned there. And, but there's also those people that really inspire you and the people you look up to. And, you know, Jocko's a guy that, you know, he's got real world experience. You know, you can't deny that. And it's really cool to hear him talk. And he's, you know, talks about things that, like I said, are kind of, that go right along with the way I think. So, I mean, it was awesome. It was super cool.
Yeah. No, there's so many amazing people out there. And then, you know, you catch yourself watching TV, which I shut down years ago, but at the station, and you see what crap is out there. And then you kind of remind yourself that you could just use that hour, you know, with some incredible people instead of learning about, you know, the Kardashians' latest dog food that they're using or whatever the hell they're putting on the TV. So, yeah, surround yourself with amazing people and you'll be the sum of the five people around you.
Oh, so true. And yeah, on that note too, I want to thank everyone that, you know, thank you for your time. I, like I said, I'm truly honored to be on this podcast, and you've had some amazing guests. And like I said, I'm super humbled to even be, able to talk to you. And then along those lines, you know, I wouldn't even have this opportunity if it wasn't for John and him reaching out. So I really appreciate him. And, like I said too, with this new project I got going, I got an amazing team back me, and, you know, I'm super grateful for all the things that, all the opportunities that have been laid out. So thanks, James.
All right, Paul. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate it. And it's been another, you know, amazing episode, and picking, a firefighter that's been through some pretty incredible coaching prior has been phenomenal as well. So thank you for your time, and hopefully we will talk face to face one day in the near future.
Awesome. Thanks, James. Appreciate it.
All right, mate. Take care.